And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. We're going to attempt to have a couple of guests on today. Sometimes we don't establish connections with them. It's a busy world, but we are looking to get somebody on who's written an article, somebody I've interviewed a few times before on the radio, who is a clinical psychologist who writes articles on politics and how psychology works in the American public, not just individually. And that's Bruce Levine. He's a clinical psychologist, and he's the author of a book called Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. And this is a new book of his that came out recently. He is also, as I said, a clinical psychologist. His books include Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, How to Find Morale, Energy, and Community in a World Gone Crazy, and Common Sense Rebellion, Taking Back Your Life from Drugs, Shrinks, Corporations in a World Gone Crazy. He is a practicing clinical psychologist, often at odds with the mainstream of his profession, and a regular contributor to Counterpunch, Alternet, Truthout, Z Magazine, and the Huffington Post. And as I mentioned before, his latest book is, which is a terrific book. If you want to read a book that gives you some hope, that energizes you, not just a book telling you, as I easily do every week, and other people do all the time. I mean, the amount of bad news that piles up and the amount of difficulty that anybody who wants to protest or dissent faces in modern America, I mean, it's almost unprecedented. But the amount of trouble we face, and then you get dismayed, to say the least, right, when you pick up the paper and you read the news and you see what happens to anybody who wants to express dissent. I mean, even people in the Occupy movement, clearly 99% of whom, to use a certain, you know, terminology, want to peacefully protest, want to be nonviolent, they get treated as if they were terrorists. They get actually lit. The Homeland Security is actually involved in suppressing the Occupy movement. I mean, so now they're terrorists, right? The people who want to actually kill Americans or blow people up, those I might think you would call terrorists. But people who want to express their First Amendment opinions that the country is being stolen, or has, I should say, has been stolen, and they just want to try to get it back from the rich, they get treated as if they were actually terrorists and put on terrorist watch lists and everything else. So this book, Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite, by Bruce Levine, it's a terrific book. It's full of energy, it's full of passion, and it's full of hope. So I would strongly recommend this book to all of you. I will try to make sure it's listed on the archives of this show, so that everybody can keep referring to it. And I would urge everybody to go out and get this book. When he's on the line, or if he's on the line, do we have him? Yeah, we do have him. Okay. Bruce, you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Mike.
Okay. Just gave you a recommendation, especially your latest book, the one that came out, you know, last year. It's full of hope is what I like about it. You know, there's a lot of criticism and a lot of dismay about the news, but this book is full of hope. So,
well, you know, one of the things that I think about a lot is that, you know, how you could provide realistic hope, because, you know, I mean, for me, it's sickening and it's insipid and it's depressing for me to actually hear kind of Pollyannish sort of stuff. And so a lot of my writing and a lot of my books are for people who have brains in their head, are critically thinking, anti-authoritarians who really know that in many ways it is fairly bleak out there in terms of we've got all these industrial complexes running our country, from the military industrial complex to the energy industrial complex to my business, the mental health profession, is run by a psychiatric pharmaceutical industrial complex. And people know that. You can't, you know, it's not
right. You don't want to sugarcoat.
You don't want to provide unrealistic hope. But I think, you know, given that scenario, are there any things that people can do to deal with their own personal depression? That was the previous book that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And then given that reality, you know, is there anything that we can possibly do that history tells us that can be done, given our own sort of political malaise and our political apathy?
If you were to apply a psychiatric term, this is too pop, but I'll ask it anyhow. If you apply a psychiatric term or terms to the current state of the country, what would that be?
Well, we'd go with two. And I don't think that these are kind of common sense terms. I mean, most of my profession is either, you know, filled with BS or, you know, it just tries to make a big deal out of basic common sense. Mm-hmm. And the basic common sense is that people do move into a kind of state which psychologists started calling a generation ago learned helplessness, which means that, you know, when anybody, they've done lots of experiments on animals, you couldn't get away with this today because of ethics and stuff, but mm-hmm. but they did experiments where they put animals in situations where they had absolutely no control over electroshocks that were hitting them, dogs especially, and then when they put them in other situations, the dogs that had experienced some control, in other words, that they could stop their electroshocks, they would move out of one situation and escape it into a place where they weren't getting shocked, and the dogs who could easily just jump over a barrier to escape their shocks, if they had been trained in helplessness, they wouldn't even bother trying. And so that's one explanation for American people. We've moved into a kind of learned helplessness. Why? I mean, look at, we put most of our democracy eggs into one basket called electoral politics, and we get thrown at us year after year, presidential elections where, you know, we got one candidate who's for corporate control and senseless wars, and so we replace them with another candidate. Turns out what they're in favor of is corporate control and senseless wars. This is what's happened with Obama, mm-hmm. but this is what happens with people. So you go for a third party, and third parties have no chance because of money in America, so they lose. You stay home and you don't vote, which is what a lot of Americans do, and I totally understand that. Mm-hmm. You know, is what do they get? They still get a Democrat or Republican and senseless wars and corporate control, and so that's learned helplessness. So that's one kind of psychological explanation.
Well, just to amplify that a little bit, I mean, what you had is when these two wars originally, now they're 10, 11 years old, well, one of them's assumedly over, but it's not. You know, these gigantic outpourings all over the world, but in this country too. And then you get poll after poll after poll of a majority of people. I mean, it becomes kind of a sad, surrealistic joke. A majority of people don't want the war. Millions of people turn out, hundreds of thousands on the streets of cities. Absolutely nothing. Means nothing, right? So
right.
That's where
that's
the learned
right.
helplessness
comes. People may forget. I mean, people have a short memory in America, mm-hmm. but you're absolutely right, Mike. In 2003, February 2003, we had 500,000 people in New York City showing up protesting this, you know, Iraq war. And then, you know, in Europe, you actually had the largest protest ever in London. It was the largest protest ever. And even in a very conservative city like my own here in Cincinnati, Ohio, where, you know, that's where Bush came to announce the war because he figured he wouldn't have much. Well, you had 5,000 people protesting. I was out there in the crowd, and what happened to people was that people realized, oh my God, it's senseless. It doesn't matter. People had a sense that if we had 5 million out there, they're going to do whatever the heck they want.
So
it
you
doesn't
get a,
matter.
You,
they don't care what we have to say.
Right. You get a feeling that democracy just doesn't work at all anymore. And then, of course, what the problem with that is that people either will have learned helplessness, which is what they have generally. But the other thing is that if they're going to show you that democracy doesn't work, and they show you very clearly over and over again, then you have other alternatives, you know, and they're not pleasant.
Right. You know. Right. I mean, the other kind of psychological explanation that I talk about a lot, there's a few, but the second big one is what I call basically people are in this corporatocracy abuse syndrome. And I mean, the corporatocracy I've talked with you about before, just real simply, some people call it the corporate state, but it's really what rules America. It's these ridiculously, you know, large, too big to fail corporations, these banks and insurance companies, and these ridiculously wealthy people like the Koch brothers and their corporate collaborator politicians. They rule America, and people are in, like, sort of moved into kind of abuse syndrome where, you know, a lot of progressives I talk to, they get very upset with me because I, you know, when I tell them, like, you know, you get to a certain point, I don't know if you've ever been in an abusive relationship or you've had a friend mm-hmm. or, you know, anybody you've known have been in an abusive relationship, it doesn't help to tell them, hey, you know, your partner's beating the crap out of you, or emotionally, you know, beating you up or, you know, ripping you off financially. They already know it. And I think a lot of people out there who've been gone to school for too long, they think that information alone can set people free. And they think, well, if only everybody read all my books that expose mm-hmm. all these industrial complexes. And they kind of, in some ways, insult the American people, you know, that certainly a lot of Americans are ignorant of certain things. But generally, the polls show we know enough to know we're getting screwed. We know enough to oppose these wars. We've opposed them for several years, 60-65%. We know enough to know we're getting screwed in terms of our health care. Again, take a look at the polls. I go through them all and get up, stand up. So the idea that we're ignorant alone is being the reason reason why we're getting abused and oppressed and exploited, it doesn't cover it. It's much more the fact that people move into one of these kind of abuse syndromes that a lot of other social psychologists around the world have talked about, and colonized places, subjugated places like South America, Central America. People talk about this kind of fatalism and defeatism, but Americans, even American social scientists, we're too embarrassed. We can't admit that we too are a subjugated society and that we've moved into these abuse syndromes.
Well, also, I guess the whole country is suffering from Stockholm syndrome. So,
That's one thing that certainly happens with a lot some of these people. I mean, Stockholm syndrome, for folks in your audience who don't know it, it's like a bank robbery in Stockholm, Sweden, where the captors actually started to identify with the people who were putting them in harm's way, who had taken them hostage. They started to feel positive about them. So some people talk about it, especially some of these guys in the Tea Party, that they're suffering from Stockholm syndrome.
Focusing in on this part, because it's a million things. This branches off into a million things. Speaking of which, you mentioned some of the stuff that goes on in your profession, psychology, right? These things that come up, the best thing they've come up with recently, which fits into everything you're saying, and is this classification of an illness for which they prescribe, mostly for children, billions of dollars of drugs every year called oppositional defiance disorder. Right.
I love that one.
That's the best one they've ever come up with.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I try to do in Get Up Stand Up is to kind of talk about all the different spokes of the wheel, culturally, psychologically, that are oppressing us, that are keeping us subdued. And one of them, I've embarrassed for several years, is my own profession, the mental health profession, which has for many years now kind of pathologized, sort of medicalized rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about one of the most obvious ones. There's a lot more subtle ones, but the most obvious one, one of the most obvious ones, is this thing called oppositional defiant disorder, which was invented, literally. I mean, the American Psychiatric Association has this book called the DSM,
right,
which is the Diagnostic Bible, and they just invent diagnoses. And so in 1980, God love them, they finally took out homosexuality as a mental illness, only because gay folks protested and they were fed up with it. But the same year in 1980, by the way, the same year Ronald Reagan becomes elected president of America and we swing to a more authoritarian society, the American Psychiatric Association puts in all these kind of mental illnesses for rebellion, and ODD, oppositional defiant disorder, was one of them. And literally, the symptoms of these, I mean, I'm not joking, I'm not being sarcastic for your audience. Yeah. Symptoms include often refuse to comply with adults' requests or rules, often argues with adults.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't be laughing.
No, it is. I start laughing about this all the time. And Mike, I tell you, the good news is when I talk about this to media across the political spectrum, not just guys who are hip to certain things like yourself, but even mainstream media, even some of these folks on the right, they start to laugh, and they see how absurd it is. Only people who don't laugh at this are my profession, the mental health profession. And the reason why is I think they're the only people out there who have never rebelled against authority.
Well,
and
see, so
they pick these people to be the ones to pathologize folks who do rebel.
Well, also then, as you make clear in your book and many other times that you've written about this, there is no difference between the pharmaceutical industry and a large part of your compatriots there. For instance, maybe they took homosexuality out of the DSM because they didn't have a drug to fix it. So who's making the money? No, there's no money. Show me the money,
So right, I mean,
oppositional defiance disorder, there's plenty of drugs they can pump into kids who talk back to the teacher or look out the window when they're not supposed to,
Right. That's right. I think that's one of the things that the left has been a little slow to catch, that a lot of these so-called liberal institutions, which of course, mental care about mental health is a liberal left kind of a thing, but they have been slow to catch up on the fact that these, industrial complexes have swallowed them up, so that psychiatry was kind of a dying profession in the 80s when they decided like the only way to keep it going was to allow the pharmaceutical companies to annex it.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they got almost every major mental health institution, from the American Psychiatric Association on and on, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. They take millions of dollars from drug companies. Why? Why do drug companies want to work together with them? Well, obviously, if we can create these illnesses and popularize them and then sell drugs, not just one drug for them. By the way, nowadays, if they're not happy with just giving one drug for each of these illnesses, people get multiple drugs for each one of these.
Well, also the idea of giving this stuff to children. I mean, basically, that's what upset people in the 60s and 70s about drug dealing. dealers, that they were selling drugs near schools. It even upset the mafia dons in The Godfather. We don't sell this stuff near schools. No, now they don't sell it near schools. Now they sell it in schools. Right.
Right. Exactly. I mean, now kids are being forced to take them. I've got situations where once in a, you know, every year or two, a parent comes to me and, you know, and hope, you know, and because they're afraid their kids are going to be taken away from them because they don't want to give their kids speed, which is what these, you know, ADD medications are. I mean, that's what they are. Amphetamines. Adderall is an amphetamine. And so, you know, now, you know, that's the case. But, you know, when you've got huge money behind something, you can convince people of all kinds of hypocrisy. And so now you've got actually all, if you take a look at almost everything that the mafia made money off of, is now being replaced by some sort of gigantic corporation. So loan sharks, the credit cards are now doing the loan sharking. My business, the mental health business, is now doing the drug dealing, you know, on and on. The state is now doing the numbers running called lotteries. Actually, they give worse odds than the mafia used to give.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
So on and on. That's what these guys in the mafia, you know, knew. I was like, well, we're, you know, they're just going to like push us out and replace it with corporate America. In the state.
Well, you know, speaking of, here's a perfect segue for us too. This whole idea of oppositional defiance disorder, because this show is dedicated to the Occupy movement, and we're uniting the two things immediately here. First of all, as far as the government is concerned, you literally are a terrorist now. You know, the Department of Homeland Security is way into this with local police departments, with the Occupy movement, and so if you oppose it, you're mentally, if you're in the Occupy movement and you oppose all this corporate greed and corporate control of America, either you're a terrorist or you need to take a pill. There's some, or you're mentally ill, one of the two. But meanwhile, I want to talk about this article recently that you wrote. And the title that I read it on Alternet, it says, How America's Obsession with Money Deadens Us. Let me just read the first several lines of it, and then we can talk about this. All right.
Sure.
A preoccupation with money is nothing new in our culture, but have Americans become even more money-centric? And does this deaden us, make us incapable of resisting injustices? A money-centric society is one in which money is at the center of virtually all thoughts, decisions, and activities. While capitalism certainly gives rise to money-centrism, I guess so, any society in which individuals have little know-how and lack supportive community and are thus totally dependent on money for their survival will create a money-centric society. And finally, such a society coerces even the non-greedy to focus on money at the expense of damn near everything else in order to survive. You know, this country started out, the reason they threw the tea into the harbor was it was about money. It was about taxes. You know, part of their, one of the reasons the Americans had a revolution, those particular Americans who had a revolution, aside from the abuses of them stationing troops, you know, and using bayonets and no freedom of speech and everything else, and, you know, it was based on money. This country has been a money country since the beginning. The minute the Dutch set foot in New York City, it was all about money. The Indians were all killed because they had land, and the Dutch actually said, they actually gave a rationale, and I read this in a history book, why they thought that the Indians should be moved away or dealt with, you know, to use a phrase, because they had all this land and they didn't develop it sufficiently, right? So it's always been a money society, right? There's nothing new about that in America, correct, as you say?
Right. Right.
So what is different now than it ever was? This country has always been about money. I mean, the flag could easily be a $100 bill. So what's new?
I think what's new is how much, a couple of things. One is how much ordinary folks who are not greedy are forced to kind of think about money like 24/7 just in order to survive. And, you know, and where does that, you know, and how greed has become really a respectable kind of thing in American society, American culture. I mean, how that's really kind of changed and how, you know, people, you know, have become more and more sort of like insecure and overwhelmed by their fears, and that make them like kind of thinking about money, you know, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's really the thing. And that, of course, you know, money has always been a big deal. But there have been many people in, you know, American history that could go for days on end, or you know, not really having to completely obsess and focus on it. Now it's literally almost impossible. I mean, the only people who are not doing that 24/7, it seems like, are people who are homeless, and even they get to a point where they have to be pretty much thinking about it.
So the only people who really aren't worrying about money are the this what's called the 1%, right? They don't have to worry about money if they're putting in a basement in their house that has a bowling alley and you know.
But they are too. I mean, they're worried about it not out of fear of not having enough. They're just worried about greed. I mean, so that's the I guess so you know there's the two forces that make you be money centric. One is fear, and the other is greed.
And you mentioned here that I'll quote again from your article. The sociologist Robert Putnam reported in Bowling Alone, and this verifies what you were saying, which was written in 2000, that when American adults were asked in 1975 to identify the elements of the good life, you know, Obama always talks about the American dream, right? 38% in 1975 chose a lot of money, compared to 63% who chose a lot of money in 1996. And since then, I don't guess we don't have anything new about that, but if you ask people now, it might be 85% of the people, you know. And as you say, it's because people don't feel secure. Also because the prices of everything, you know, through monopolies and through control and through whatever else, are so high that people can't possibly compete. And now you've got the situation like, for instance, where fire departments, you know, this privatization of everything, like fire departments in some communities are charging people to arrive at fires or not.
Right.
You know.
Right. Well, I mean, you just take one simple example. Like, I grew up in New York City, and this would be true for people in California and a lot of places in America. In the 70s, if you were working class, I mean, you wanted to go to college, you went to college. You didn't have to worry about money. You didn't have to worry about whether, you know, what your parents did for a living or if they were unemployed or whatever the hell they were. I mean, it was free. I mean, so that was one huge area that you, as a young person, you didn't have to worry about. Now, in my, you know, practice, I do a lot of family counseling. I can't tell you how many hours I spend with families, with parents, with their 17, 18-year-olds, you know, talking about money in terms of college, in terms of, you know, having them understand the difference between taking out $20,000 worth of student loans versus $80,000, you know, talking about scholarships, talking about, you know, in-state and out-of-state tuitions, you know, just obsessing about that, you know. So even at that level, you know, I'm finding like a lot of my day is spent not only worrying about my own damn money things as insurance companies are ripping me off and I have to fight for them all day long, you know, but with like clients are just constantly worried. And, you know, you talk about other areas, you know, I talk about, like, for example, if you wanted a life where, you know, you could do a job that you didn't have to get rich, but you didn't have to worry about money all the time. You know, you go into something like my dad worked in the post office or people become teachers and it was pretty secure. But nowadays, those are not secure.
And you
no
could buy it
there.
And you could buy a house and you could buy a car. I mean, how did that happen, and how could it possibly not? I mean, well, you know, let me be a devil's advocate here for a second, all right? In part of your article, you're saying lacking job security is a big thing we're talking about here. But in the Declaration of Independence, it says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And this is what the right is always screaming about they, you know, people always want a handout or, you know, you should be able to make it on your own, whatever. Now, you know, obviously that's complicated. But where was it ever written? Where has it ever been guaranteed in life at all or in the United States of America that you have a right to job security?
Well,
I'm just being,
not,
you know, I'm being a pain in the ass.
No, I mean, there's a couple of things off of that. Number one is, I mean, actually, Tom Paine actually did talk about sort of a kind of a welfare system that the rich should contribute to certain kind of things, but people don't want to talk about it. It's really funny. Guys like Glenn Beck talk about Tom Paine all the time, but they never want to talk about his book called Agrarian Justice. But at a deeper level, I mean, you know, it was back then, before you had, the state, really, the U.S. government being used mostly to kind of support giant businesses, including agribusinesses and control food prices and all kind of stuff. I mean, it was much easier for people to be self-reliant, and that there were many other, you know, ways that, you know, that people could survive. I mean, to be a family farmer, there were lots of other different things that people can do, and so, you know, the state has been used, and you know, in American history, for really the benefit of gigantic corporations and the wealthy, and to make ordinary people more scared, more insecure, more out of control. I mean, to make them, I mean, terrified that if they don't comply, even, you know, by going, you know, to school nowadays they have to get a college education, or they're told that they're not worthy of a job. Well, you know, so it goes, you know, on and on, that it's been made difficult through this kind of, you know, the economy that has emerged for people to feel secure.
You know, Where in the world, is there some place in the world, obviously you're very familiar with history, right? Or, you know, where in the world has there ever been a society, or is there a society now where people, where, you know, where, which isn't money centric? I mean, obviously wherever we go, we bring this contagion with us. When we go to Afghanistan, now, it's not as if there wasn't corruption in the world before. Or,
well,
you know,
it's a question of degree. It's always a question of degree. And I think if people go, for example, in Northern Europe, places like Sweden, Denmark, they would see less money-centric places. Why? Because people are not in America, for example, you know, you lose your job in America, you lose everything. You know, you're one step away from not only, you know, if you've got a health problem, you're going to move into bankruptcy, and boom, your life is gone. You know, and most of the rest of the industrial world, you know, it's not great to be unemployed, but, you know, a lot of these places, you'll be supported in unemployment for a significant period of time, much longer here. You'll still have your health coverage. You'll be able to go to school and get retraining. And so, yeah, everybody still thinks about money, but there's not that enormous kind of terror that you have here in America, that if you don't have the green stuff, you're completely screwed.
Well, I mean, there's all these songs from the I recently reread Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. I mean, everybody should read that book, right? You know, people forget. I mean, obviously, what's these endless sayings about history, like Santayana, you know, those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. But if everybody just reads the Grapes of Wrath, you'll understand there's nothing new about this kind of thing. It happens in generational or even multi-generational cycles in this country where the rich, they're always there. They're there like a hand pushing against your forehead or on top of your head. You always have to keep pushing it away. You read about the Gilded Age. You read about the union movements, the struggles in the 30s, then the struggles in the 60s. You know, it just keeps happening all the time. You have to maintain an eternal vigilance. But here, the Occupy movement has decided, and for every good reason, that money has corrupted, obviously, politics completely, corrupted everything. People used to talk about all these phrases politicians use, like a level playing field. First of all, there's never been a level playing field in this country, but I think, if I read American history correctly, there was somehow more of a level playing field than there is now, right? Less of a grip on everything than the way there is now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, back, for example, I mean, I have a quote in that article that you're talking about, the, you know, FDR or Franklin Delano Roosevelt quote, where he can, you know, where he talked about about organized money being dangerous to our government. And really, the phrase goes, he says, we know that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. Yeah. You know, and then we move to the kind of Obama era here, where Obama's, you know, talking, I have a quote there of where he's talking about, like, what nice guys, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, Lloyd Blankfein, you know, and his $9 million a year, and Jamie Dimon at the CEO of Chase, you know, making $17 million. Oh, these are nice guys, and ball players can make that much money. And so you definitely have a very different era in terms of, like, what is socially acceptable to talk about rich folks being, that it's okay to be greedy. That's a dramatic change.
I guess if anybody watched A Christmas Carol now, they would have trouble identifying who the villain is, right?
Right. I mean, that's another point I make there. I mean, you know, like, once upon a time, Scrooge was clearly, you know, he was a villain. But nowadays, it's really okay to be a Scrooge-like person in America and be, you know, that there's no great shame in that.
I guess people would watch, they would watch A Christmas Carol and they would say, what is the problem with Bob Cratchit? What does he want a handout for? He's already making money. He's getting paid. I mean, what is the problem? You know, kids die all the time.
Well, that's certainly a kind of Republican view of it. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if he doesn't like, that's what he'd say. If he doesn't like it there, he should go find another job elsewhere. That would be a Republican view of Bob Cratchit.
Yeah, well, you know, let me just read this quote from FDR, and this is the difference between him and Obama. He says, we know now that government by organized money, as you said, is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. This is when he was running for office, obviously. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred. And he said this, I think, at Madison Square Garden with 19,000 people standing on their feet and screaming, right? Can you imagine Obama saying a thing like this today? And he winds up by saying, I should like to have it said of my first administration that the forces of selfishness and of lust for power met their match. I should like to have it said of my second administration that in it these forces have met their master. I mean, a lot of people had their feelings about Obama that quickly got dispelled. But then, as you point out here, he says, well, you know, these guys from Chase and everywhere else, they're nice guys. You know, I met them. Nice guys. So this is where we've come anyhow. So this idea of being worried about all the time, like on my show, you know, sometimes on Sirius, people will call up and say, you know, yeah, it's very nice all the stuff you're saying and your guest is saying, but meanwhile, I got to go out and make a living. I don't have time to be going out in the street. You know, I don't have time to be occupying anything, right? I mean, what does an average person do? As you say, if people are so worried about job security, so worried about money, people are working 2-3 jobs, both people in the family are working, you don't know where your money for food or rent is coming from. Who's got time to be protesting or to be occupying? And yet people did this in the 30s. There was like a million people in the Communist Party.
Right, That's something people need to remember. There were like, you know, when you had 25-30% unemployment in the Great Depression, you had the time of the greatest. That's when you had the Flint sit-down strikes. I mean, you had people taking over factories. So it's kind of a myth that just because we have high unemployment, we have nowhere near the unemployment that was there in the Great Depression where people had a lot more guts and a lot more courage. So to answer your question is really at any level in our life, you know, maybe you don't want to go, you know, you hang out and to the Occupy movement. I would recommend people go, especially if they're in a place like New York or D.C. where, you know, some of these places. I would recommend that you just check it out. You might feel energized in a way that you've never felt in your life and in many years. But if you don't want to do that, I think there's a lot of other ways that I talk about in Get Up Stand Up that you can just move out of this kind of learned helplessness, and you can move out of this kind of state of being in an abuse syndrome. Because, you know, the bad thing is that we've got all of these spokes in the wheel that are kind of oppressing us, my business, schools, you know, on and on. There's a lot of different things that are kind of controlling us. But the good part about that is that we don't have to wait to the electoral process. We don't have to wait every 4 years to this kind of demo, you know, these elections that happen. That there's lots of things that we can do each day to kind of basically get back our guts, get back our kahunas. And really, a lot of it is, you know, for me, what I'm trying to do for folks more than anything else is to in my own profession, kind of help delegitimize an illegitimate authority, like my mental health profession. You know, that the higher ups there have now been taken over and corrupted by these drug companies. And you know, so one of the things I try to model is that any professional taking a look at their own area, you know, there's plenty of things that they can help delegitimize. And what that does is it gives you some energy. It helps people around you get some energy. And a lot of what I wanted to talk about in Get Up Stand Up was just how we get back that energy to do battle, because there's a lot of strategies and tactics, you know, and I get into that in the last section of the book, but unless we have that energy to do battle, we're not going to utilize these tactics and strategy.
Well, there's so much more to talk about, and which we will do on yet another show, but this whole idea, and everybody is thinking about this for a long time now, but there's a lot more articles about it, which I'm pleased to see, which is just clicking a mouse is not going to change the American government or the way of life that we have. So, you know, it does it dramatically in some cases, like Susan G. Komen and like that, but it isn't going to get to the basic problem. You get a lot of referrals from your compatriots, from your colleagues?
I mean, there is a sort of a network kind of, what do you want to call it, dissident mental health professionals around the country. And there's actually a lot of us, you know, mental health professionals who agree with me, but they're afraid. You know, they're afraid to come out, you know. They're afraid to come out of the closet, you know, and because of the repercussions that you have to face. But, you know, I get some, but generally I get money more from other folks. Mostly, like, especially in a place like Cincinnati, I guess I would be considered a pariah mental health professional, not a dissident.
If you lived in New York and I was familiar with any family that had a kid having trouble in school, I'd send him to you instead of somebody else. I mean, oppositional defiance order, give me a goddamn break. You know what I mean?
Really?
It's only natural not to sit still or pay attention in school. It's unnatural to pay too much attention in school. Anyhow, this is Bruce Levine, and everybody needs to get this book. It's called Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. And is that Chelsea Green?
Yeah, Chelsea Green.
Okay, so everybody, get this book. You want to read something that's going to cheer you up. You know, this book will do it. It'll give you tactics, give you strategies, and it's written with tremendous passion. So, you know, we'll talk again.
Sounds good, Mike.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Bruce. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Everybody, please go to the Facebook page. I want everybody to get involved in the Facebook page. Also, I know it's the modern world. I don't want you to just like it. What does it mean that you like something on the Facebook page? Don't just like it. You got to say something. and comment. If you see stuff that I put in there or other people put in there or videos, or you see stuff about my show that or the show that we did today or any other show, then comment on it. Put your own comments in it. Write an essay. I don't care. You don't have to be articulate. Just write something, right? But don't just like it. I don't want to see any more thumbs coming over my email. I'd like to see some words on the Facebook page. And the way that you can go to the Facebook page is just Google Occupied Territory and Facebook. Google Occupied Territory and Facebook. Now, we're going to have another guest on with some interesting news about the Occupy movement in just a minute or two. We'll take a slight musical break and we'll be back. All right. It's come to my attention here. By the way, this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader, and it's only one of the many programs on PRN-FM. You're listening to PRN-FM. I hope you know that since you had to go on the website and click on it to hear it. Our programs are all, this program and other programs are all on archives, on podcast. And we have a tremendous lineup on this station, a tremendous lineup. I would venture to say, having had extensive experience with this, that we are probably the most forward-looking, probably the most aggressive and the most liberal or even radical liberal radio station in the country today. So PRN.FM, and it has filled in the gap that was left by other places that did that once upon a time. We have a guest with us, Brendan Christopher Lengel. You there?
Yes, it's Brenton, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. Brenton. I got it wrong.
Yeah,
I read it wrong.
That's all right. Everybody gets it wrong like five times.
Yeah, well, you know, I have a higher responsibility since I get paid so many millions to do this. All right.
Absolutely. That's why we do it, sir.
Absolutely. What else? Brenton Christopher Lengel. And let me just introduce you a little bit. He's a playwright, poet, actor, and Appalachian Trail 2000 miler. Really? You did that?
Yep. Wow. Walked from Maine to Georgia.
Amazing.
2,176.5 miles. And then I wrote a play about it called North to Maine, which will be going up in New York off Broadway for about a month-long run this coming fall.
Really? Oh, well, congratulations.
I'm excited.
So Brenton holds a BA in theater from the University of Kentucky. And let's see, moved to New York City in September of 2009, currently resides in Sugar Hill, where he writes theater and performance art reviews for Examiner.com. Mm-hmm. Etc. And this is kind of startling to me. I was at BAI. I was the assistant manager of BAI in New York City for a while, and then I spent 25 years on the air at BAI up until around 2004 and left for various reasons. But according to this, now BAI has had a program for quite some time now. I guess it's since the fall. From 6 to 6:30 or 6:30 to 7 every weekday on the Occupy Wall Street movement, correct?
Correct. Right. 6:30 to 7.
6:30 to 7. Okay. And who were the producers of that show?
The producers of that particular show. I'm blanking on the names. Mm-hmm. We have that show being produced. One of the producers is Faith. And the other is Ellis.
Are you associated with Occupy Wall Street?
I absolutely am, yes.
Okay, so according to this, and you can verify whether this is true or not, then maybe I can get some other stories here. Occupy WBAI, you've occupied the station. Now, why would you occupy a station, which is one of the few stations in the country that's paying regular attention to the Occupy movement?
Well, actually, you are entirely right. They are one of the few stations in the country that is paying regular attention.
Aside from this station.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Well,
besides your station. By the way, I loved what I was hearing before.
Okay.
Anyway, we actually have a prepared statement here, so I'll just go down through it. Ladies and gentlemen, esteemed listeners, we have occupied WBAI. Who are we? We are concerned listeners no longer content with passivity. we occupy in honor of the grand tradition of the Pacifica Network as an active source for free speech and new voices. This station is the media, is the main media outlet to take the time to listen to and amplify our voices rather than exploit them to further the cycle of corporate greed. However, we feel it is time to offer our favorite station some tough love. As the tide turns across the country and around the world, we must turn the tide at WBAI. We demand, first, that 12 new seats be added to the board of directors, each filled by a person under the age of 35, to add youth and energy and strategy for the growth of the network. Two, that the staff committed to this goal be maintained and cultivated. And three, that WBAI sustain and expand its dedication to social progress by continuing to provide an outlet for the voices of the 99%.
Now, let me ask you a couple of questions, Mason. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. How much longer is it?
It's just another, couple sentences.
Okay, go read it. Read it.
Yeah. If you, the listeners and supporters of this station, stand with us, call the station to make your voice heard. The board of directors will be meeting at 388 Atlantic Avenue at 7 p.m. The revolution belongs to the youth. We're here, and we ain't going nowhere. If you want to call in to support us, call 510-402-9880. I'm sorry. I gave you the wrong number.
Yeah.
510-849-2590, extension 208.
Well, that's going to be, what we'll do is if you send me an email and I'll give you my email address, then I'll put that on the archives of the podcast here.
Sounds perfect.
Okay. So let me ask you a couple of questions. I mean, I BAI is maybe was one of the two or three major parts of my entire life for all sorts of reasons. And let me ask you a couple of questions about what you just said. You haven't told us why it is that you're doing this. I mean, if BAI is, as you say, one of the main places that's featured what's going on in Occupy Wall Street, maybe they came to it a little late or maybe they don't give it enough time. But if they are one of the few places that's paying attention to it, and BAI has a great tradition of doing all this. In fact, BAI helped stop a war and helped get civil rights and rights for gay people and for women. It's a major player in this country. And even though it's fallen on somewhat hard times in various ways, it still is one of the few stations that's doing that. Why bother a place that's doing that? Why don't you occupy Fox or CBS or ABC? Why are you bothering them?
Well, specifically at this point, we don't have a chance of getting Fox or ABC or MSNBC or really any of the major corporate media networks to actively report on us.
Yeah, so why pick on one of the places that is reporting on you?
Exactly. And we're actually in danger of losing that.
So now we get to the point. So how are you in danger of losing it?
Well, what's happened is that we have a very beloved program director here. His name's Tony, mm-hmm. and he's absolutely been phenomenal for the movement. He's brought in a ton of money to the station here. Tony Bates, he raised $1 million in their most recent dry fund that hasn't happened since 2005.
Well, aside from how wonderful he is, I mean, what else is the problem?
Well, the thing is that he is bringing in new blood, and he's backed off a little bit on kind of the old standards of the station, is instead bringing in younger people and younger shows. Mm-hmm. A great one, actually, that literally just came on the air is Occupational Hazards with John Murdoch and Joey Gay. There's a number of Occupy-related shows and Occupy-friendly shows that the station is in danger of losing.
Danger of losing it?
They're interested in firing Tony Bates, as far as I understand it. The board is meeting today with the intent to fire him.
But maybe it's for other reasons. You don't know all the reasons, do you?
Mm-hmm. Well, once again, from what I can tell, both from my comrades here and from the reception we've actually had at the station, once again, I can't comment on specific individuals, mm-hmm. The overwhelming consensus is that, this is basic politics. I mean, Leon Trotsky said that one of the most important things about a revolution is to keep a perpetual state of revolution going on. And it's extremely important in the arts, in entertainment, and especially in journalism that this happens. I mean, I've worked in a huge number of major arts institutions as I've been coming up, in smaller positions usually. And I find a lot of the time that these arts institutions become very fixated, very set in their ways. And it's really funny because the Pacifica Network and the people here on the board did almost this exact same thing back in the 60s and 70s. And it's, you know, and now they're having to deal with the next revolution. And sometimes people have a difficult time with that.
Well, I mean, so one of your demands was, let's see, 12 new seats on the BAI board for people under 35. Isn't that kind of like discriminatory? Why, I mean, what's wrong with somebody you could have somebody who's 40 years old who's completely for you, right? What kind of narrowing is that?
Well, they already have 24 full seats. We're not asking them to cut the seats and give seats over to people under 35. We're asking them to open up the station to us. They will still maintain a majority. But the main instance here is that, especially in today's day and age, what we're seeing happen is that more and more we're seeing distribution channels be closed off. The theater distribution channels are being closed off.
Well, but I think you're wandering off the topic. I asked you a specific question about it. You know, for instance, I am nowhere near 35, and I'm way beyond 35. You know what I mean? You know, I've been this show has been on since, I think, November, and it's entirely devoted to the Occupy movement, right? I know plenty of the guy I was just interviewing.
Thank you very much, by the way.
Well, that's okay. I'm not saying it for that reason. And the guy I was just interviewing is a psychologist, who's in his late 50s. I talk to people all the time who are out there on the street who get arrested. I have people on. Bill McKibben is on. I have Chris Hedges on all the time, right? Mm-hmm. I have all these people on. They're nowhere near under 35. I don't like this whole idea.
Well, you know, once again, we're not taking your voice away. We're asking our voices to be added to it.
Well, you're already on. There's already a program. I'm sorry to be devil's advocate here, but that's, you know, it's somehow you arrive at something closer to truth when you do that. But basically, you want people on who are younger. I think that's a sort of very narrow-minded, very limiting way to do things. Wouldn't you say you would rather have people on who are more dedicated to having more airtime for the Occupy movement? Wouldn't that be a better way to do it?
Well, once again, that's our second demand. And the thing is that what we're finding here is that a lot of the time there are older voices are very, very heavily represented, both here at this station and in just about every entertainment and news business around.
So you're saying it's just that they need like a forcible injection of youth, right?
They absolutely do. I mean,
that's your point of
radio,
view.
All of these mediums, old media is dying. Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing is that a lot of the time, instead of embracing change and embracing the next generation and the generation that a lot of us, we really have very important things to say. What you see is that the people that were originally in our position are clinging to basically control their distribution channel.
Well, it's true. It's an old story. And Pacifica does have that problem, and I know as well or better than anybody, having been involved in it for more than 40 years, or was up until 2004, I should say, when I left because I couldn't take it anymore. But, I mean, when you say...
So you see where I'm coming from.
I understand that. I mean, people... I know what happens at certain places. People, especially nonprofit organizations, and especially nonprofit media organizations, and when you get these kind of radio stations who have been dedicated, like no other stations, to Pacifica Foundation to justice movements and to, you know, equal rights movements more than anybody else. There's nobody that even compares with them. What happens is after a while that people have their programs and it's almost as if they got a deed from God, like the Israelis think at the West Bank. You know what I mean? That the station belongs, that the airtime actually belongs to them. It is very hard to change anything and people get set in their ways. I understand that. But I mean,
you actually just highlighted one of the main reasons why I consider myself an anarchist.
Which is?
I founded a theater company called Autonomous Collective, and the whole point of it was no gods, no kings, no artistic directors. So often these places become cults of personality. They become for these people, and they stop really being a relevant voice. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily happening here, but I'm saying if we don't stop it now, that's very much in danger of happening.
Well, the only danger I see with BAI, and I understand your dedication to the program director and your, you know, quoting a fact that he's raised all this money and everything like that. In fact, there are other facts about BAI is that it's perpetually almost on the verge of bankruptcy.
Yeah, it takes $3 million a year to run it.
Right, and there's fewer listeners, I think, than they've ever had relative to the population.
Yeah. So it's old media is dying.
Well, when you say old media, maybe we should just throw out all the radio stations and move straight to the internet. I mean, that's the way things are going anyhow, right?
There, if that happens, that's going to happen. But you shouldn't get rid of a distribution channel just because it's old.
Yeah, this is,
I'm a huge
fan
of newspaper comics, for instance, and they haven't had anything relevant to say for 20, arguably 50 years.
Okay, so the program director, you're saying, and I really can't comment on that because, you know,
yeah,
I have...
it's professional.
That's not that. That's not it at all. I mean, I can't comment on it because I personally don't know the man. Also, I also can't comment on it because I'm friends with lots of people who have shows at BAI, and I receive constant emails and I'm on the phone with them all the time, and they don't have a very good opinion of him. So, in other words, if I was to comment on it, I'd be throwing my weight in a direction, and I don't feel like doing it. So I want to stay objective about this.
I appreciate that.
Okay. Now, so what I would really wonder about, though, is whether or not he's still the program director. Let us say the worst happens, as far as you're concerned, and there's a new program director. Why does that place the Occupy movement and BAI, why does it place Occupy programs or Occupy-related programs in jeopardy? Why couldn't a new program director see very clearly that the Occupy movement is the future of the of the protest movement in this country? Why wouldn't somebody else be able to see that? Is he the only one who could see
that? In theory, there's no problem with that, and I agree. And another program director could easily see that. However,
if I was, I would have you on.
Why they're talking about getting rid of Tony is because of the younger Occupy-related programming that he's doing.
Well,
they
like
want
what?
To go back to a more traditional.
What is some of the Occupy programs?
The Occupy programs that we have right here. We have the Occupy show from 6:30 on. We have Occupational Hazards with John Murdoch and Joey Gay. We have a lineup actually for the next 4 hours or so of very friendly Occupy-related programming. We've got our friend Comrade L here, who's been working and helped to facilitate a lot of what's been going on. And he runs his own show here, his own radical communist and anarchist show. So there's a number of programs that are coming out that people are tuning into, that are bringing in donations, that are bringing in money to the station and bringing in new listeners and new blood.
I get your point here. But what about all the other things that are going on in the world that people on BAI, maybe they don't do it as well as they used to, and maybe some people still do, but there's a million other issues that they all blend together, obviously. We all understand that, right? It's all part of the same problem. But there's plenty of other people who are who have expertise on the radio, who've been on a long time, or even who are young people who have expertise in the radio, who talk about specific subjects like health. They talk about, gay rights, whatever it is, Native American rights, whatever it is, the prisoners' rights. All these programs, I mean, why would you want to interfere with any of their airtime when it's all to the same good purpose?
Well, it's less about interfering with their airtime and more about making sure that we get our airtime as well. I mean, the programs that we have are by no means taking over this station. We're not trying to turn this into, the Occupy station.
It almost sounds like it is.
I can't see that it would be. I mean, we've got a couple of shows. We have, very short airtime. The Occupy show that you cited only runs for 30 minutes.
Now, that I can understand. I'd like to see that be an hour a week, but I'm not the program director.
And we've got other shows that run for 2 hours. We have some shows that were 2 hours and were cut back to 1 hour, and they're mad about it. I mean, there are great shows that can run for 2 hours.
So part of this is a generational, it's like an eternal generational struggle, right?
Absolutely.
You're in the studio of the station right now?
I am actually in Tony's office. We have occupied it. I am sitting in his chair and my feet are on his desk.
Okay. Is there anybody in the studio, or are they doing their regular programming now?
They're doing their regular programming. Uh-huh. There are folks in the studio. We were in the studio on the air last night, actually. Mm-hmm. We came in and occupied. The host of the program was very friendly to us, and he allowed us on to speak for a few minutes, and we had it live streamed. It was absolutely amazing.
Is there any way you can tweet us a picture or pictures of what's going on down here?
Yeah, I can absolutely tweet you guys
pictures. We'll put that on our station here, on the archives, and on our own station, all right?
Absolutely. Okay. I know we've got live stream from last night. I can send you the live stream of all of us in the studio talking about this, making our signs.
Well, whatever. Just tweet this stuff and give us what you can give us, and we'll try to arrange to put it on, some of it on. I do feel a little uncomfortable because although I do...
Of course you do. The youth are standing up.
what I feel uncomfortable about is that I'm talking to one side of it. I usually don't do this. I try to do research and do like closes. You know, I do a lot of editorial stuff where I don't worry about it's journalistic, right? I just give my opinion. But in this case, I'm hearing from one side of the issue. And, you know, since I don't listen to BAI as much as I used to, I know only that they have that show at 6 o'clock. You've told me about other shows. Is there anybody else that's there right now who is with the station, like the manager or an assistant program director or an engineer or something who can speak to me for a minute?
Specifically, well, that might be a slight issue because we don't have anybody in the room right now, and also WBAI staff can't comment on specific staff and specific issues.
All right. Yeah, I know. That's an old rule down there. So obviously BAI is not going to call the cops on you. They'd be the last place in the world that would do that, right? So.
Yeah, no, they haven't. And honestly, I do want to say this. I am by no means throwing WBAI under a bus.
I hope not.
A huge number of the staff have been extremely supportive of us. They have been, obviously, I can't mention names, but there are a lot of them that get it, and there are some of them that don't, and, you know, they honestly do have legitimate grievances at times.
Well,
and
somebody was just mentioning to me, I'm hearing information from all over the place, you know, it's I'm hearing voices. by the way, if you're listening, just tuned in, or you're listening now, we're talking to Brenton Christopher Lengel, and he and some other people, I guess from Occupy Wall Street, or he is at least from Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, all of us are.
Okay, did this go through the General Assembly, or is this just something you all decided to do?
We are an affinity group. This did not go through the General
Assembly. An affinity group. Somebody told me that there were some arrests at the station last night.
There were, actually.
Well, who got arrested?
There were one person who got arrested. She was live streaming. And then there were two Pace University students that had come out with us, and they had been they were not arrested, but they were issued citations.
Well, why were the police there at all?
Honestly, the police harass us constantly.
No. Why were they at the station? I mean, they would have to be called by the station to come in there, right?
Well, yeah. Well, the thing was that in order to get past security, you have to be on the list here at the station.
And you
so
were.
I was on the list. A number of other people were on the list. We'd made arrangements ahead of time
Some people weren't on the list.
Some people weren't. Some people had decided to come with us. Some people supposedly had been on the list, but there had been a typo in their name. So we had a group came in, and then a group waited outside for us.
All right. So I only have a minute left. So basically what I'm hearing is that you and some other people from the Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street specifically, have occupied BAI, one of the few places in the country that historically has helped groups like Occupy Wall Street that's even paid attention to them. It's still one of the few stations, along with PRN here, that pays attention to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting some... So this is something that I find a generational problem. There's always an argument for airtime, but I am. Did you speak? We only have like a minute left.
Yeah,
did you speak with the manager about this before you did it?
The general manager of the station?
Yeah.
No, I did not. Other members of our group may have. One of the things about being an anarchist is you do things without permission.
Mm-hmm.
I always find it's better to ask for forgiveness than to ask for permission.
Well, I guess
the other good thing, and I do want to mention this,
is that our
occupation of the station is by no means a negative mark on the station. We have a great affection for this station, and we are occupying it out of love. It's tough love, but it is honestly something that we feel is in the best interest of the station in the best interest of the listeners.
Well, if any place I guess should understand is it's BAI, so it's up to them to figure out how to deal with it. And programming airtime is very precious down there, and I understand that. But of course, it does have a great history, but this is what we will have to figure it out, and we'll see how it goes along. I mean, I guess I'll keep reporting on it.
Absolutely. I'd like to say really quickly, by the way, that I've been saying this all night. I've really been enjoying my time here. And this is honestly like an 80s movie come to life. We don't have Cusack yet, but we'll track him down, and a guy with a very funny voice.
All right. I don't know what I am speechless about all of this. But people can make up their own mind about what they heard you say today. I just sometimes wonder, like what happened with the Park Slope food co-op recently, that the left is really expert at destroying itself. And not going after the real targets. But let's see what happens down there.
Yeah, I definitely won't disagree with you on that.
Okay.
At certain instances, however, I feel that in this thing, we are once again not attacking WBAI.
Okay.
We're keeping WBAI transparent, and just like I expected you to hold my feet to the fire, and I really appreciate that. You know, we're going to hold WBAI's feet to the fire because we're all in this together, and we really all need to maintain a level of transparency. And that's really one of the major things that this movement is all about. Is
well, I only hope that you can raise money off it. I got to go.
Yeah, all excellent. Right. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, Brenton. Thank you very much. That's it for today. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Poor BAI. That's it. That's all we got to say today, except for our final quote from Thomas Jefferson. He said, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies." Right on, Tom.